All right. You see, the thing to do is to get it all coordinated. I mean, I have a figure. You see, I figure this way. Here's the way I got it laid out. I figure one day we're going to discover the plan. Right, friends? I mean, after all, it's been 34,000 years of recorded and unrecorded history, and everybody's been trying to figure out how we can fit all these little pieces together, you know, get the jigsaw puzzle all working, see? Well, I figure one day we're going to get the plan, huh? Figure that, huh? One day, when we're all working together on it, we'll get Pfeiffer on it, we'll get Lenny Bruce on it, we'll get Norman Mailer on it. We'll get all the real big thinkers of our time. We'll all get together and figure out the plan. Of course, the only trouble is, you got to be careful of the soreheads. They're the guys that are always going to be giving you trouble, the soreheads. And the best plan, see, as a matter of fact, for those of you who don't have the chance to get the out-of-town newspapers, the soreheads are still working out there beyond the darkness. You think just because the New York Times isn't publishing that stuff isn't happening? Phew. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, the secret is this, that since the New York Times is not publishing, I'll give you the cue. Just watch me. That's all. Just watch me. Now, it'll be definite, boy. I'll jump up and bang on a glass. You see, the secret, I tell you, has it ever occurred to you that now that the Journal American ain't publishing and Dorothy Kilgallen is not there, and that Leonard Lyons is, you know, I don't know what Lyons is doing today, and that the New York Times isn't doing it. Do you realize what the mice are doing? You see, because the big eye isn't on them. Well, I've got some indeed. I mean, just think what you can get away with now at El Morocco without Leonard Lyons and Dorothy Kilgallen to lay it down the next day. Oh, you should see what's going on at 21. You don't know what Liz has been up to lately. Whew. Boy, Earl Wilson, isn't that his name? The fat one, Earl Wilson? Yeah, the one with the fixation on the things, that one? Yeah, he sure got a fixation there. It has to do with lactation. There's a lot of problems. We can get into that a little later on. That's for later on in the course. You see, we'll give you a lecture course later on about that fixation. That's a very serious fixation in American life. There have been all kinds of things that you don't know what the fixation is at Earl Wilson? Oh, of course. What is it? Well, it's been called a lot of things, you know. I'll never forget my old man. He used to give it a kind of a parallel. He used to talk about water wings. You remember water wings? I mean, you know, I'll never forget the time Aunt Teresa went right to the bottom of Lake Michigan in 7 feet of water, wearing a pair of water wings that were fully inflated. Well, her specific gravity was pretty high because she had plenty of bile. Well, bile is something you just can't measure, you know. You just can't measure. It's something, believe me, that doesn't come in Carter's little liver pills. And the kind of bile I'm talking about, by George, it's vibrating. Well, anyway, the mice are out there playing out in the darkness, see. Now, as I say, we're going to get the plan. There's no question about it. Mankind is marching forward, right? Little by little, we're fixing it all up. You're clearing it up, you know. We're cleaning the windshield of existence off. Dusting off the pool table of life. Racking up the pool balls of eternity. Who's going to break? Well, you want to flip? Well, we're getting it set. Got to have the plan. But you got to be careful of the sore heads. Like, for example, I have here before me a little bit of evidence that I think should be reported to you. It comes from Miami Beach about the soreheads. I don't know how the plan is going to take care of this type. Somehow, I am with the soreheads inevitably. Listen to this one. Miami Beach, United Press International. Auto mechanic Otis Turner was driving. He's 37, which is a crucial age, by the way. Auto mechanic Otto Turner. And believe me, being named Otto is bad enough. Otto Turner was driving leisurely around Miami Beach when somebody started honking at him from behind. Well, when the car stopped for a red light, Turner got out. He raised the car hood of the horn blower and triumphantly yanked the wires loose. The beeping stopped. But before Turner could get back into his car, no, it's the other one. Now, see, you got to keep the sequence there. Now you guys have killed the whole thing now. You see, you made the change at a crucial moment, and we've flubbed the dub. All right, we'll wait till you guys get set in there, and then we'll go on. All set, fellas? Just you, I'll wait for your cue. I think that'll be better. Now, all ready in there now, fellas? All right, let us pretend that I had gotten to the point of the gag and my engineer was with me. This is what would have happened, friends.
You can get water where there ain't any fail.
Boy, I'm a born wire puller. I'm going to jump right on the top of that hood one day, and I'm going to jump right on your turntable, and I'm going to pull all them wires out. We can't get loving when... All right. Now, is that better? You know, speaking of all love, I mean, it reminds me immediately. This is WOR, AM and FM, New York. Other stations may claim it. Now, get it all set up in there, Ralph, because that's a perfect one for that. You know, other stations may claim it. Throw it again. I'll just give you the cue. Now, hold it now. Just watch it there. Boy, oh, boy. I'll just try it. Maybe seven times. Other stations may claim it, friends. And they do. Those phony stations down the dial, those shouting, hollering stations that don't have John Gambling on them. And you know Gambling's got the clear blue light of sincerity in that old eye, boy. I'll tell you that. Why, there isn't a station in all of New York that has got a man who lays down the truth more honestly, more sincerely, and I might also point out, more consistently, about frozen asparagus than Alfred McCann. He does not quail when he gets into that frozen food. And when he's talking about them specials from Bohack, you can hear the quiver of a religious fervor. Where else you going to get this? How many of you have quailed before the thin cutting blade edge of Carlton Fredericks's infinite scorn for the glop you're eating? Speaking of glop, this is WOR AM and FM, New York, the station that really loves you.
But you can't get loving where there ain't any love.
That's right. You remember that sales department. And speaking of sales departments here, we've got great news for all of you. Ex-newspaper readers, Walter Winchell, the greatest New York columnist, is back in town. Oh, whoopiesville. Every weekday, for the duration of the newspaper strike, you'll find Walter Winchell of New York in Metropolitan Daily. You know, it's great to be leading in a race where there's no other competitors. But nevertheless, let's pat him on the thing there. And they're available at your local newsstand. You know, speaking of newspapers, though, and seriously, friends, The little moment of truth where the guy jumps out of his car and runs around the back of his car, whips open the hood, and yanks the wires off the guy's horn behind him is, I think, an extremely significant little news item. Because I believe in many ways it tells us why there can never be a plan. There never will be a plan. Because, well, I mean, it always saddens me. One of the things that saddens me more than anything else, I think about just being alive, and yet it amuses me at the same time, is the great, ever since I'm a little kid, the great human, what is it? Is it an illusion? I don't know. Desire, dream, you name it. That one day the perfect plan will be discovered. The perfect way of life. Well, now, of course, always coming along with that, Ralph, is the concomitant thing that says, well, of course, now since we've discovered the plan, we're going to have to do something about the wise guys who are going to cause our plan not to work. Now, let's try to reason with them first. And then everybody takes his plan with the big signs, the thing that says love, or great Scott, or fantastic, relate. That's a new one. You know, something like that. And they march across the street where these other guys are, you know, and they say, now look, fellas, the thing to do is love. Hubble, 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 hubble. And a brick comes flying up. Well, then somebody hoists the sign that says, relate! Out comes a milk bottle. Pow! It lands in the middle of the street. Well, then the forces of good always regroup. You see, incidentally, all forces call themselves the forces of good. Even Dillinger felt he was on the right side. He just wasn't in, you know, all he wanted was a little dough and quit arguing. Well, no, I'm serious. Nobody considers himself on the forces of evil. He never thinks of himself on that side. So the forces of good regroup. That's wrong. Well, what are we going to know? And somebody says, well, let's make bigger signs. I don't think they're reading the sign right. That's what it is. I mean, Fred, you got the sign, the one that says be friendly. Well, why don't you paint the thing in red there, friendly in red, and underline it with blue. Blue and red, white, it's nice. And you, the one that has the thing that says love, you've got to get that one. We got to get that one with a battery on it. It's got to have lights and neon. Love is the answer to everything. We have that thing there. And you, the one with the sign that says relate, will you please hold it up higher? Quit dragging it. They got to read it. All right, now you're all set. We're going to make another push. All right, so now they got the batteries. You see, it's all wired up. And the forces of evil, which is always the other side, is standing on the other side of the street. Well, across the street comes the first guy with the big sign that says, love, love. That's better. Love. Okay, so he's got the sign that says, love. Whee! Plop. Great big fat pumpkin pie. It's been kind of, you know, mistreated. It lands out there in the middle of the street.
Will you read a sign for crying out loud? Love!
There's a moment of silence, and then they hoist the big one that says,
relate! Remember, relate!
Plop! An unmentionable flies out of the crowd. By now, the crowd is getting teed off. They've had enough of the signs. Up to this point, you see, they've gotten along okay with their... And then the last straw comes along. This big idiot comes rushing across the street with a great big thing that says,
be friendly!
And so it always goes. And then, of course, the guys with the signs rush back and get their mortars, their peace mortars, and their friendship machine guns. And about 25 of them whip up their relate hand grenades. And, of course, the other guys are defending their position. And then it starts. Now, it is also axiomatic that whichever side wins is therefore then judged the right side. Because the only guys that are left, usually after such a fiasco, are the guys that win. And so it is naturally assumed they were on the side of right. Well, then gradually, on the other side of the street, another crowd starts to gather. These are guys that weren't even in on the first one. Pow! Ad infinitum, ad nauseam, ad whoopium. You see, because it isn't really something to be regretted. It is just naturally life. Shamugu. You know, speaking of life, set that thing back. We'll get it set back, Ralph, because this is a wild thing. Speaking of life. Have you ever really been in serious trouble? Have any of you ever really been in I'm serious. I'm really leveling here. Have any of you ever been in genuinely serious trouble? I mean really serious trouble. Well, I can think of about 15 types of serious trouble, and so can you, Ralph. I mean, the kind of stuff that, oh, boy. I mean, the kind where all of a sudden you get that wild, salty taste in your mouth when the phone rings and you know this is it. They have finally discovered. Well, now, I don't know. I presume that the ultimate trouble that you can imagine yourself in. Well, now, again, that's very interesting because Sartre has written about this, with another people, too, that each man carries along with him his own private hell. And that, of course, relates to what he would consider the ultimate trouble. So, it is a brash and untrue assumption to believe that the termination of life would be the ultimate trouble. Because, as a matter of fact, for many people, the ultimate trouble is life itself. Hence, the termination of life would be, in many ways, the cessation of the ultimate trouble. Whereas, for another large percentage of the population, it is literally the opposite. Now, this has been the subject of plays. It's been the subject of philosophical discussions from time to time. Now, I'm sure that each one of us in our lifetime, sure, I know it. I know this for certain. Each one of us in our lifetime has tasted in one way or another that peculiar salty taste of the big trouble. I mean the really big trouble. And I'm not talking about, you know, I'm talking about the kind you don't even joke about afterwards, Dad. You just hide next to the hot air register, you know, and you hang onto the hat rack. And boy, you just hope to the devil that it doesn't come back. It was a near miss this time. Now, a lot of guys had this happen to them in the army. Because I want to tell you, though, interesting thing. I had a little thing happen to me. On the way back from Philadelphia, I do a thing in Philadelphia once a week. A little television show. And on the way back from Philadelphia a couple of nights ago, late at night in a train, I'm sitting in the train, and it was hot. And trains, as far as I'm concerned, I love to ride trains, but trains today are the greatest advertisement for not riding trains. I don't know what's happening. Oh, it's terrible. I mean, you're knee-deep in cigar butts, and they're hot, and they're dirty. The windows are always dirty. And I know immediately I'm going to get a letter from the public relations head of some railroad and say, Shepard, you haven't ridden our Whoopi special that goes to Denver. That's true. But I ride trains every week, and you're going to have to do a lot of convincing to convince me that I'm that myopic. Believe me, 4 hours after I get out of the train, I'm still unloading cigar butts from my socks. I'm sorry. And they're old cigar butts. So, you know, Jersey is not that gray. It must be the windows. I will enter that train and the sun is shining and the next thing you know, it's raining in the car and there are clouds in there and lightning. And all the while, you know, I see people outside walking around and I think it must be sun because they don't have their raincoats on, but boy, it's awful gray. Terrible. Well, anyway, that's part of it. It was night. Believe me, it was night at 3 o'clock in the afternoon one week I'm on the train. That was another story too. But I'm sitting in the car. Got the picture. Now, it was a grotesque situation anyway because I was surrounded by the indigent members of a strolling group of players. They were going apparently to Boston from Philadelphia with some turkey of a musical. And I don't know, I mean, I just assume all musicals, you know, that's just the way musicals are, you know. A lot of razzmatazz and guys playing banjos and people hollering and playing like they're 19 years old, you know, the whole bit. You gotta suspend all belief to like musicals. Also, all musical taste, too. Which bothers me a little bit, too. But nevertheless, I'm sitting in this car, and I'm surrounded by these guys. And for some reason or other, this musical has required them to grow beards. Nothing is worse than a group of bearded strolling players wearing Russian hats and little fuzzy shoes. And so they're flitting back and forth in the car. They're whooping it up, you know. It's a kind of a whoopee, thin, shrill whoopees going on. And the car's getting hot, and the cigar butts are up around my ankles, and it's rattling. You can't look out of the window. It's like there's one big tunnel between Philadelphia and New York, and it's called Jersey. Well, I keep looking at you, and once in a while they stop in the tunnel, and it says, you're now in Trenton. Trenton, Trenton, Trenton. And you look out, and it's like somebody's made a tiny porthole in the tunnel. And you look out, oh, that's Trenton. For crying out loud. And you see these people moving in the gloom and the haze out there. And it's, oh, those poor guys. It's Dante. It's hell. Well, you're always glad to get back to the big town. Or Philadelphia. Crying out loud. Jersey must be a coal mine. I don't know whether it's the trains or the Jersey. I can't figure it out. So I'm sitting in the train. You got the scene now. It seems like it's about 4 a.m. Actually, it's only 2 a.m. and it's getting hotter and hotter and the steam is, either the trains are freezing your thing, well, they're either freezing you or else it's going, and somehow down around your ankles, there is some infernal box. Some box that has nothing but live steam shooting on you or something, you know. You sit there and you, oh, shoo, and your socks burst into flames. And your head is cold. I don't know how it works, but it's very interesting the way the heat works in those things. So, yeah. So I'm sitting in the car. Well, let me tell you the scene. I'm sitting in the car in the back. And they've got this little thing in the back, you know, where it says you can smoke. Well, the only reason I'm sitting back there, it's not that I smoke or don't smoke. I don't care one way or the other, you know. But I'm sitting back. It's the only place where I can get a seat. And I sit down, and there's holes in the seat where the Marlon Brando types have carved their initials, you know, and the springs are popping out. And the guy keeps hollering, man, that's a place where you got to get to drink here. This is a drinking bar here. It's a drinking place. Well, you know, I'm sitting there. So, all right, I'll sit down. I'll order a warm Coke or something, whatever they got. So I'm sitting there trying to make it last all the way to wherever I'm going, which is New York. And you gotta get the picture. All these guys with the beers are sitting around me, see, and they're flitting. Whoopee! They flip back and forth. One thing you know about a musical company that is on the road, there's a great, I don't know what the business they've always got in the next car. There's a continual running back and forth from one, whoopee, whoopee, well, it's going on and on, like, Charlie. And it's just a wild, see. Dickie, well, I'm sitting there awash in this stuff, and I'm contemplating the state of American theater as the parade is going past me, and it's getting later and later. Well, the flitting gets quieter and quieter until finally we are almost at a state of quiescence, which means that they were all half gone. I mean, they're just sitting there quiet, nothing. Their eyes are glazed over for a while. Once in a while, you hear a little faint whoops or a little faint whoopee. You know, just a little flutter there for kind of, so it's all quiet and down, and the steam is going, and the ordinary travelers are sitting there. You know, it's wild to see the musical comedy types in the midst of all the insurance salesmen. Then you really get a cross section of the way the world really is. Well, I'm sitting there. You got this. See, my head is slowly starting to go down. The steam is going. Well, directly across from me is one of these angry musical comedy chicks. Now, generally speaking, the musical comedy chicks are far more virile than the other people that are in those plays. They really are. I'm telling you, they really are. I mean, they're sinewy and angry. And, you know, they're the kind that can grind valves and you know, and yell and holler and all that kind of stuff. So this chick is sitting across from me. And you can just see she's made out of solid flint. Well, she's wearing the little whoopee shoes and all that, but don't be fooled by that. When she opens her eyes, there are two twin agates looking at you. I mean, polished agates, like that, see? Look right through you and pin you to the wall. Boy, I can picture relating to her on stage. Let me tell you, oi, oi, oi. Well, nevertheless, that's beside the point. I'm sitting there, seeing I'm slowly beginning to drift. Everybody's kind of drifting, quiet there in the car. Well, this chick is sitting directly across from me. Not a sound, except this, the train, you know, the infernal machine is squirting it out, and the cigar butts are rolling back and forth. Suddenly, I'm aware of a movement, a tiny movement, just it caught my eye, you know, like some little paper cup or a snuff box or something rolling around under her seat, right over across from me. It's just a little movement. And I sort of open my eyes, and there I see, coming out from under her seat and coming right along next to her foot, and she's just sitting there completely oblivious, a genuine, fur-covered, mouse-colored mouse. A genuine mouse. It was the first genuine thing I'd seen in the train. And it goes, and it stops, looks around, I look over at the mouse. And everybody's sitting there drowsing away. And this chick probably is the kind that would go screaming. Just has that look, you know, that taut look. Ooh! You know, that would go screaming right through the ceiling. Bounce right off the top of the tunnel and ricochet all the way into Delaware. If she knew there was a mouse within 5 miles of her, you know. Well, the mouse is sitting like an inch and a half from her shoe. You go, I sit and look at the mouse. It's a mouse. For crying out loud, it's a real, live, pulsating, gray mouse. Well, the mouse is casing the joint, see? Obviously, this mouse lives in the train. So the mouse is not a stowaway. Everybody else is, you know. The mouse is permanent party. So the mouse looks up. He cases the joint, gets the lay of the land, and goes... He disappears into the darkness again. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, for crying out loud. Now, wait a minute. Get a hold of yourself, Shepard, now. It's just this musical comedy troupe. It's the beards, the whole thing, you know, and you're tired. It's the hissing and the train and the banging. For at least a minute, I could not believe that I had really seen a mouse in the train. Long, pregnant pause. Shepard is now 3/4 awake, which is at least 1/4 more than I usually am. I am at alert. Out from underneath the darkness again comes this little guy, this little gray mouse. He is now, see, he spotted what he wants now. Little sniffings. He crunches down. I look over at him. He looks me right in the eye. The two of us are looking at each other. This little tiny black bead of an eye. And the mouse is looking at me. I'm looking at the mouse. Have you ever caught an animal's eye? Well, I caught the mouse's eye. We're just sitting there. He looks. I look. And suddenly he goes, whoop! He grabs an apple core. Runs back into the darkness. He had gotten what he wanted. And then I look over at the chick. This chick had no idea that a mouse had been within squeaking distance of her foot. And then it suddenly hit me. Shepard, how many times have you been pursued by dragons? And you never knew it. How many times has the leering evil face of total disaster stared over your shoulder and you kept chewing your juicy fruit, popping your bubble gum, waiting for somebody to hit a foul ball up in your section, and all the while someone was sitting behind you polishing the blade, picking out the rib? Yes. And there I sat, popping my gum, eating my ice cream cone, dozing off, letting the sun play down there on the top of my head. And all the while, this dragon was stalking with claws. I stand singing, oh, I'm the Sheik of Araby, la-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, la-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Gee, I wonder when the ball season's going to open. It's going to be great to have the ball teeth. And then I turn behind me to hear what the noises are. And just as I turn, whatever it is, slithers back into the shadows. Well, I guess it's just the shadows. Oh, I'm the Sheik of Araby. La-da-da-da-da-da. La-da-da-da-da-da. And then the dragon decides that I, Shepherd, am liable to stick in his teeth. And that anyway, he's having a little gas on the stomach. And all the while, I'm walking along. And the dragon goes home, puts away his blade, his burglar kit, puts away his set of teeth, and quietly goes to sleep next to the hearth. And Shepherd wanders along on his carefree merry way, believing that the entire terrain is totally free of dragons of all sorts, and hoping that the Mets will win a few this year.